Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Good morning, New Orleans. Our thoughts and prayers go out to Glenn Boyd and his family on the passing of his beautiful wife, Nancy Parker Boyd, happy, kind, hardworking. I was very fortunate to be able to share and spend some time with Nancy on many occasions because her husband, Glenn, actually worked for me as a public information officer at the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office and developed a relationship with Glenn and his family that we truly enjoyed. Their children, Parker, Piper, and Pierce, our best goes out to them. Our thoughts and prayers to the Fox News 8 family as well. Your work family, in many respects, is right there with your own personal family, day in and day out, always very supportive. Our thoughts are with you as well. Nancy Parker Boyd definitely made a difference in our community, and we're thankful for that. In the last hour, we're going to be talking to Christian Garrick and do a little after action on his second preseason game against the Chargers, and his Teddy Bridgewater, the future at quarterback, will get what his thoughts are. In the second hour, we're going to be talking to Leon Cannizzaro, New Orleans District Attorney. What really happened at the Juvenile Justice Center? Can't figure out who's on first, what's on second. We'll try to get the answers to those questions. And in the end, does it really matter? Should we be focusing on other issues? And has the DA been right all along? When you look at the presidential candidates, and you look at politics state level, local level, or otherwise, education and the challenges of turning a school around is the subject of an article by Dale Chu, our senior visiting fellow from the Thomas Fordham Institute, that joins us. We're going to talk about what are the things that we can look for that are consistent in turning schools around. But we're also going to find out, I think, that it's a very difficult thing. Dale Chu, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Noel. Great to be on.
Dale, I read your article called The Messy Reality of School Turnaround, and I guess to sum part of that up is there's no one kind of silver bullet panacea solution. It depends on a lot of different things having to go right in order to do so.
I think that's exactly right. When we look at sort of the rate of successful school turnarounds across the country, the rate has actually been fairly low because, like you said, Noel, there are a lot of things that go into determining whether a school can successfully be turned around. If we've, you know, folks in education in many states have been trying this now for decades, yet we keep seem to be hitting a wall over and over again when we're trying to do this work.
What do we see that is the persistent or consistent failure that really is difficult for not only educators but experts in the field to get their hands around these issues and kind of move the system to the next level?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the issue is there's a lot of disagreement when there is a school that is failing what to do, right? I mean, it starts there. One of the biggest issues, having done this work myself in the state, are some of the racial issues that are involved, right? Oftentimes when a state elects to go in and turn around a distressed schools, oftentimes the decision makers are mostly white and the schools that are being affected are mostly minority. And right there off the bat, you get a whole bunch of really, really tricky politics that are that honestly have really not as much to do with actual hard work of turning the school around academically. It just becomes this cauldron of many things that invariably sort of keeps the schools from moving forward.
Dale, do you see that the structure of governance, I know in the state of Louisiana, we have these unique local school boards. Some of the folks on these school boards are actually educators. Some come out of the education field. you know, my experience in working with them is that they kind of focus on issues that are not the vision, not the mission, not strategic plans, but almost like picking out the color of the walls on the carpet. And and we seem to get mired down and bogged down in things that really these boards from a governance perspective shouldn't even be thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, Newell. I think, you know, a lot of, school districts, school boards specifically, often tend to resist these types of interventions. And what we've also learned doing this work over the years is that when local leaders, school boards, superintendents are resistant to receiving assistance, it makes that work all the more difficult to undertake.
So when we look at the failures, those are pretty consistent as they break down into their silos where the cost per student is going up. I think Colorado was spending $132,800 for each student. That is a staggering number. When you look at what was going on in Providence and Mayor Bill de Blasio's program to turn around the public school system there in New York City, there's similar stories in L.A. You can almost pick a state. It seems to me that there are some things that reveal themselves, you know, teacher shortages, student-teacher ratio. School discipline seems to come to the forefront. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely expensive to do. It's like I said earlier, it's extremely political. And there's no sort of right combination of things, right? I mean, there literally is. I mean, if you look at what states have done across the country, there's a veritable laundry list of approaches, whether it's replacing the teacher, replacing the principal, changing the governance model, changing the textbooks the schools use, changing the length of the school day, you know, bringing in coaches to work with the teachers, bringing in quote unquote turnaround specialists to help support the school. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And states have thrown everything against the wall, but there is no right magical combination. And so sort of my perspective on this is that it's less about those specific strategies that you try, and it's more about what conditions exist locally in the state, in the school district, that are as important, if not more important, than whatever specific things you try to do.
Dale, we got to go to a break. When we come back, I want to talk about the three things that you outline in your article that you think are needed, and there needs to be some consistency in order to reach some level of success. We'll be right back with Dale Chu, Senior Visiting Fellow for the Thomas Fordham Institute. Stay with us. We're with Dale Chu, Senior Visiting Fellow from the Thomas Fordham Institute, and he's the author of a piece called The Messy Reality of School Turnaround. And he starts the article off saying that 10 years ago, then U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan issued a clarion call to turn around 5,000 of the nation's most distressed schools, serving nearly 3 million students. 10 years later, what do we find today, Dale?
Well, frankly, we find the same sort of situation, right? I mean, when I was doing this work in Indiana, the first step we took when we were addressing our distressed schools is just we did an audit and went in to look at what was happening in some of these buildings. And just to show you one example, Noel, is our team went in to observe what was ostensibly a business 101 sophomore high school class. And when our team went in and observed what the students were actually doing, they were filling out McDonald's applications. And this was, you know, these are high school students. It's this kind of thing. It's heartbreaking to see. It's the reason why when Duncan issued that call 10 years ago, that he felt this is something that we as a country really need to do. Unfortunately, 10 years later, look around the country. There are still plenty of schools that are in the same troubling situation.
We had a story here just recently, Dale, something very similar. Graduates from high school could not count change. And you know, when you think about that, how tragic that is. If you're leaving a high school, going off to college, and you don't know what a nickel or a dime or a quarter is.
Yeah, but if we decide not to address these issues when, you know, when these students are in school, then as a society, we address it one way or the other when these folks are out in society and they're finding themselves struggling and not able to find gainful employment. I mean, the urgency of this particular issue is hard to overstate.
In your piece, you say, under what conditions does school turnaround work? And reflecting on your time you said, in Indiana, you said there are at least three that come to the forefront of your mind.
Yeah, I certainly think in Indiana, a key part of our effort there really depended on leadership. You certainly need leadership, I think, at all levels, the federal level, the state level, and the local level. But given that this work is largely state-dependent these days, the governor, whoever the state chief is, the state board of education, those folks really need to be singing from the same page of music in order for this to happen. Unfortunately, I think when you look around, you know, look around the country, folks are very, very hesitant to risk any political capital when it comes to doing this kind of work, just because the success rate is so low. And from an elected official standpoint, even though this is important, we know how important this work is for kids. From their calculus, there isn't much of a return on investment if they're going to try to do this, unfortunately.
In the private sector, Dale, I think they would call that engagement and buy-in, right?
I think that's the thing. I think that's exactly right.
Seems so simple. And I loved who you quoted. You quoted former Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, who said that anyone in an elected position or aspiring to be one should be able to name one cause he or she would be willing to lose an election over. And I think, as you so appropriately pointed out, there are so many that run for political office never wanting to look themselves in the mirror critically and identify that one issue.
Yeah, this is I know that not just a sense of not a source of frustration for me, but when I'm looking at just even what's happening nationally in terms of the scores of folks that are running for the Democratic nomination for president next year, when it comes to this issue of education, so much of the rhetoric is around just throwing more money and more resources into the system, which is not to say that there isn't a need for more resources. That's a great, that's a debate we should be having. But when it comes to sort of, efficiency in the system, addressing issues such as school turnaround, the candidates are frankly silent. And politically, I understand why, but from a policy standpoint and what's really, really important for our children in this nation, it's very frustrating.
Your second observation is there's no clear evidence on a single strategy that works. School turnaround must be viewed as one piece of a comprehensive policy agenda.
Yeah, for me as a parent, right? I feel fortunate enough that my daughter's in a good school. But if she wasn't in a good school, there are other schools in the area that I could switch her out of. Right? What unfortunately happens in the situation of distressed schools is oftentimes if you're a parent and you're sending your son or daughter to one of these schools, you have no other choice, whether it's by law or just by geography or both. Oftentimes there aren't many other options. So you're sort of stuck, or oftentimes folks will say trapped in one of these failing schools. In order to really address this issue, I think states have to look beyond just the issue of fixing schools, as difficult as that is, and they have to think about, okay, well, how do we create essentially a new and better supply of schools to run parallel with the current system we have, so that if you are a parent and you're not happy with the school your kid is in, you feel like they're not learning to count change, they should be able to have other options. And I think that's a key part in order for there to be long-term success here.
And I love the way you put it as well. You said there's no single 100% solution to the problems facing failing schools, but rather 100 individual 1% solutions.
Yeah, in education, we love the silver bullet. right? We're always looking for that. And we're never going to find the silver bullet. You have to recognize that if you really want to tackle some of these really, really thorny issues, you have to have a lot of individual solutions. And whether it's making sure there's a greater supply of good schools, whether it's ensuring that there's accountability in the system, whether it's ensuring that kids are getting engaging and interesting coursework. I mean, all of those are really, really important if you're serious about making sure we have great schools for every kid.
And then finally, you said, and I would add one word, credible leaders must be willing to seize upon windows of opportunity when they present themselves.
Yeah, you know, these windows of opportunity don't happen often. And in Indiana, when Governor Daniels was about to enter this work, he was going into reelection. And the person who was the state chief at the time was sort of took a much more incremental approach. And Governor Daniels, that was certainly not his MO. He wanted to do big things. And so he found someone who...
Dale, can you stay a few more minutes with me?
Sure.
Okay, let's do this. That way, I don't want to cut you off in the middle of your statement. We're going to be right back. We got to get to a hard break. CBS News. We're with Dale Chews, and your senior visiting fellow from the Thomas Fordham Institute, talking about school turnarounds. We'll be right back. We're back, and we're talking about an article written by Dale Chu, senior visiting fellow for the Thomas Fordham Institute, entitled The Messy Reality of School Turnaround. And Dale, you were talking about, finally, that leaders must be willing to seize upon these windows of opportunity when they present themselves. And that's both, I would think, politically as well as what's going on in the community at certain points in time. Is that correct?
Yeah, these windows don't open up very often. And when they do, unfortunately, many times folks will miss it and just let it pass by. But if you look around the country now, there are a number of cities where a window is open. Houston right now is in a situation where the state is contemplating replacing their entirely elected school board with a state-appointed one. And the politics are such as they've been, the district has been in such dire straits for such a long time. There's actually this momentum that they could actually do this. If there hadn't been this sort of the years and years of failure, then the politics wouldn't have aligned as they have now in Houston. But then again, even when they do align, you still need courageous leaders, credible leaders who are willing to take action.
Do you find a lot of times, having gone into troubled school districts, that they spend a lot of time on diagnostics of the individual schools as opposed to the diagnostics of the governance, the leadership, and so forth?
I think it's hard to, overstate the importance of looking at governance as a contributing factor when schools find themselves in this situation. And oftentimes, a big part of the governance issue is either a lack of leadership or just having sort of too many cooks in the kitchen. I'll give you as one example in Providence, Rhode Island. The state is now looking at going into that particular district. And one of the things they found there is that if you were a principal of a school in Providence and you want to purchase something for instructionally for the use of your students, anything that was over $5,000 needed to be approved by, I think it was at least three or four different committees. And you can sort of imagine just how that sort of gums up the works. That's that kind of thing. Those sort of systems or lack thereof, oftentimes you find them a lot in schools that are struggling.
In your experience, do you find that a lot of the governance or leadership models, do they develop like a, for lack of a better term, a school campus matrix where, the libraries are consistent throughout the school system, the technology is consistent, to include the hardware, the software, the accessibility. My experience in working with folks here is that they don't focus on those 100,000-foot levels to make sure that the educational experience or the opportunity is the same for everyone throughout the system.
Yeah, there could be, it's tough. I mean, from a governance standpoint, oftentimes in these situations, you have lots of dysfunction, right? And so whether it's lack of consistency across the district, or even just, you know, sometimes you hear these stories over and over again, where a district purchases materials, whether it's iPads or books or what have you, and then they get stuck in a warehouse. They just stay in the box for years and years and years. And meanwhile, teachers are complaining that they don't have up-to-date textbooks. They don't have technology, even though the district's already purchased them. They're just sitting in a warehouse somewhere. Just that kind of thing. Again, systems, governance, a big part of that. But oftentimes there isn't the leadership that can sort of cut through that red tape when it's really needed.
I mean, when you think about some of the top line challenges of student-teacher ratio coupled with the shortage of teachers across this country, it really is a cry out for help in many respects in trying to turn these systems around.
I think that's right. I want to say, though, when it comes to the issue of teacher shortage, I think that's something that's been bandied about across the country. But when you really look at the teacher supply issue, it's often more around specific areas rather than teachers at writ large. So what I mean by that is when folks say teacher shortage, there oftentimes isn't a teacher shortage, for instance, when it comes to finding elementary school teachers.
Right.
In fact, when you look at schools of education, they're oversupplying the elementary school teachers. But when you're looking for teachers that can teach special education, teachers that are experts in teaching physics or chemistry, those are the areas
where schools are really struggling.
Yeah. They're having a hard time finding those, and schools of education aren't doing a great job providing an adequate supply of those.
Those very classes that I still can't figure out today how I actually passed those classes, right? But so if you are from an operational standpoint of schools, if you had your top three hit list of what you would look at, what would it be?
Well, I think from an operations standpoint, you certainly want to make sure that, you know, schools are, to the extent possible, being supplied with the curriculum and materials that are needed. That's really, really important. You don't want teachers not having the materials they need to teach. I think also from an operations standpoint, you want to make sure the teachers are being and leaders, not just teachers, but teachers and leaders are being supported when it comes to coaching and training, right? And this is an important piece that we've found in schools failing year after year after year. And then also, you know, thirdly, I would say, and I think it is definitely tied to operation, is leadership, right? You have to have strong sound systems in place, but at the same time, if you don't have strong leader, a strong superintendent, you don't have strong principals, it makes all of those other issues just more and more and more difficult.
And you're talking about teacher leaders too, though, because if you have a strong principal and a weak faculty, that's not a good combination.
Absolutely. If anything, when it comes to schools that are successful, what you find is there's often shared ownership, shared buy-in when it comes to the teachers and principals. When you look at distress schools, oftentimes not only is there not that shared ownership, oftentimes you have a culture of toxicity, where the adults aren't on the same page working with one another. When that happens, then everything sort of goes downhill from there.
Absolutely. Really enjoyed your work. Really enjoyed your piece. And it's going to be interesting to see where this goes. It's an election year for us here in Louisiana, and it seems to me that in many fronts, we're not really looking and taking a deep dive as it relates to education in this state.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I think this is such an important issue, and I'm glad you're calling attention to it, Noel.
Absolutely. Dale Chu, Senior Visiting Fellow from the Thomas Fordham Institute. Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate your insight.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
We want to hear from you, 260-1870 or text 870-870. If you're on hold, stay on hold. We're going to come back to the talk lines when we return. This is Noel on WWO. We've been talking about the messy reality of school turnaround, and when you have a bunch of high school seniors that can't graduate because of all kinds of governance issues as it relates to all kinds of issues in test taking, you begin to wonder, where are we? And when I read articles across 8 different states about their educational woes, it's not unique to New Orleans or the state of Louisiana, or any other parish in the state. You're seeing this across the country. And you have to ask whether or not we're focused on the wrong thing. Let's go to Beth in Mandeville on line one. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is not exactly what you're talking about, but it is a school-related issue. Mm-hmm. There was a law passed and signed by the governor on August 1st to allow therapists, outside therapists, IM1, into the schools with the children who are autistic. Because I don't know if you know that much about autistic children, but they have extreme amount of anxiety and behavior problems, etc.
There is a whole body of science that supported that legislation actually passing.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I know the two people that were most influential in getting that law passed.
And so please don't tell me they're not following the law.
No, sir, they're not.
Right.
There it is.
Governance, right there. Governance.
It's the staff at the administration level. It's the people who think they, are God, who are the special education, the head of special education departments. And from what I've been told, that the superintendents of these school systems don't even know what they're doing. Now, maybe that's not true. Maybe they know somewhat. But this one person, Jeannie Bauer in St. Tammany Parish, is in control of all of this. The document, the policy, is so contradictory, so vague, that I've been working with these parents for a couple of weeks now, up to a month, as an advocate to try to get this done. It is just ridiculous.
You know,
it is horrible.
And that's part of the problem. And I've said this for a long time, even when I was sheriff as well, advocating on behalf of schools. I think that the single most important exercise that we can engage in is to evaluate our students when they come into the school system. Evaluate them on many different fronts, looking for dyslexia, ADD, ADHD, developing a plan of attack in order to meet the needs of that student. And better yet, to fund those schools based on school needs, as opposed to $100, just for argument's sake, for every student in a school. Well, that's great, but there are a lot of students, and I'm sure you're aware of this, Beth, that don't need as much attention as others.
Right.
And, you know, so you get the same 100 for them that you get for those that may need more. And we focus on outcomes. We look at the outcomes. They fail. And then we don't go back and try to figure out the why. Why are they failing?
No.
And just throwing money at it in a shotgun scatter approach is not going to get you where you need to go. Now, as I recall, that law just passed in this last legislative session, right?
Governor signed it
August 1st. Now, in all fairness to everyone, there's going to be some you know, implementation lag, but I wouldn't give up on it. I would call the inspector general.
Oh, no.
I would do whatever I needed to do in order to make that happen, because that was been a long, hard fought battle for a number of years. It finally passed. And what they're going to find and what the evidence reveals, and I don't know why I came across this, but I did and I read about it, is that these students will have significant improvement.
Oh, absolutely.
When they're actually able to have a smoothing of that kind of the anxiety roller coaster while in school.
Right. Well, they will not pay for, the school system will not pay for the therapy. But fortunately, most of these children are lower income, and some that aren't have their own insurance. The insurance would pay for it. There's a policy that the school could pay for it, but they never approve that. They're not approving anything right now. I think I heard Jefferson was a little bit more cooperative.
And a credible leader will take advantage of it, because they can leverage that and they can make a high-performing student out of that student with that additional help. Plain and simple, right?
As far as I can with this. Who did you say in the legislature that I should contact?
I'd contact the Inspector General.
Inspector General.
Have them go in and look at it. He's in Baton Rouge.
Baton Rouge.
Absolutely.
Right.
Because this is going to be a system-wide problem, not just yours,
it
for
is,
sure.
It is. It is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Beth, thank you for calling. We got to get to a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. And we're two games down now in the preseason for the Saints, getting closer to the opening game. Can't wait. There's going to be a little discussion here in the last hour with Christian Garrick, co-host of Sports Talk, about a little after action on what they revealed on Sunday. Tended to be a little sloppy in the first half, a little better in the second half. But these are the ups and downs, the trials and tribulations of preseason. If you're going to make mistakes, if you're going to identify proclivities, right now is the time to do it, and right now is the time to remediate it. And I know that Coach Payton and his staff thinks along those lines, and they're working towards that end. Also, remember, we are going to have WWL. Every Saints fan is a VIP. That's why we want you to experience a new Saints VIP tailgate at Benson Tower. Listen to Sports Talk every weekday during training camp. Win a pair of tickets. Here's what you get. 3 hours before kickoff, before Saints home games, all you can eat and drink. Premier open bar. Delicious buffet from Food Network celebrity chef Aaron May. It overlooks Champion Square, so it's just a hop, skip, and a jump to the dome. Doesn't get any better than that. When Cam Jordan's cue, call 260-WINS.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.